Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
My second day on the job during the lunch shift, Michelle Pfeiffer came in with her bodyguard and they said, hey, make a cappuccino for her. And I did. And I was so nervous that as I brought it to her table, it spilled and I burned my thumb. And she looked up at me and said, thank you. And I literally remember that at the end of that shift going, this is it. This is all I ever want to do.
This week, I'm very excited to welcome chef and writer Edward Lee. Ed is the chef owner of 610 Magnolia, Milkwood, and Whiskey Dry in Louisville, Kentucky. Wait, did they say Louisville, right?
Louisville. You got to say it like you're slightly drunk.
I know. Louisville, Kentucky. Yeah. And the culinary director of Succotash in Washington, D.C. and National Harbor, Maryland. He's also one of the best chef writers we have, and his writing skills are fully displayed in his new book, Buttermilk Graffiti, A Chef's Journey to Discover America's New Melting Pot Cuisine. Welcome to Special Sauce, Edward Lee, and big props to you for Buttermilk Graffiti, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great. What a terrific book. But before we get to the book, I have so many other things I need to talk to you about. So
yes.
I hope you're not planning to be anywhere in the next couple
of hours.
No,
I'm all yours.
Okay. So first of all, tell us about life at the Lee family table. I guess there were two family tables, one in Korea and one in Brooklyn, or do you don't really remember much about Korea?
No, I was born in Korea, but I came over when I was probably like 6 or 7 months old.
Got it. So you really don't have memories.
Not
much. Maybe some formula.
maybe. All my formative years were sort of growing up in Brooklyn. And you know, my parents were very interesting and very progressive for the time because, you know, most of the Koreans coming over in the early 70s were moving to Flushing. And that was kind of the Korean stronghold.
Mm-hmm.
And they decided to move to a somewhat, you know, Jewish slash Italian slash Jamaican slash Pakistani neighborhood in Brooklyn.
Perfect for a chef.
Well, yeah, I didn't know it at the time. And they, you know, they weren't intending on that. But it was something that you know, I grew up in Canarsie. And you know, I saw the sort of, you know, the last vestiges of kind of Italian and Polish and, you know, culture. And you know, there was Jewish culture everywhere. But then there were like Jamaicans, you know, there was Indians, there were, you know, so many immigrants around. And I grew up with that as just being normal.
Yeah.
You know, it was not
special.
Anything. When you grow up in that, it's just like, you know, we're going to get a beef patty and then we're going to, you know, eat some Pakistani food and then get a slice of pizza.
Yeah, you know? That's cool. And what did your mom cook?
Both my mom and dad worked in garment factories around New York City, which at the time were like, it was huge. So they actually didn't cook. It was my grandmother who stayed at home and cooked. And pretty much, you know, everything that I ate from the time that I was a baby till probably like 12 years old, you know, was basically cooked by my grandmother.
Wow.
obviously I ate lunch. School lunches, but that wasn't much to speak of. Public school systems.
Yeah.
So.
That was Wednesday pizza day?
Yeah, it was, you know, then chocolate milk was a vegetable, right? My grandmother had a huge influence on you know, defining my taste buds and just sort of like, you know, and we were poor. So, you know, it was a luxury to buy things like instant ramen or to buy things like, you know, TV dinners, right?
Right.
So
that was a treat.
That was a treat. And boy, you know, I would beg for those Swanson TV dinners. I couldn't. That was like heaven.
And what did she cook? What did your grandma cook?
It was all very traditional Korean food, you know. And she made all her fermented sauces from scratch, which, of course, you know, now is like the trendy thing. But you know, I remember my windowsill was always full of kimchis and misos and gochujangs and different kind of pastes and things, and you know, it stunk up the house like hell, but it was just part of what she did, you know, and she had the luxury of time, right? She
mm-hmm.
didn't have money, but she had time, so she would sit in the kitchen all day and make these recipes, and lots of stews, you know, lots of, and not a lot of meats, you know. Now that, again, you know, doing a Korean kalbi was a treat, you know. Most of what we ate were like lots of seaweed stews, you know, lots of broths, lots of miso-based kind of stews, of rice.
So she was doing slow food before it was fashionable.
She was doing very, very slow food, yeah. and she and it was interesting back then, you know, as coming from a traditional, you know, patriarchal Korean family, I was not going to be the one to cook, right? Yeah, I had an older sister. Right, and it's the girl that the recipes get passed down to, not the boy in the family. Right? I'm supposed to go off and do whatever boys do, and I literally had to fight my way into the kitchen, you know, because my grandmother, all I wanted, you know, when the other kids were out playing a wiffle ball, you know, I wanted to stay home and hang out with my grandmother, and.
And your sister wanted to go and play wiffle ball.
But she was out drinking.
Oh, okay.
Smoking weed. I don't know. But my grandmother would tell me in no uncertain terms, like, you're going to be a man, and this is not your place. You know, like, you don't belong in there. So I literally had to fight my way into the kitchen. I was very persistent, even as a little kid. And I basically said, listen, I'm not leaving. And she would let me hang out in the kitchen. She wouldn't tell me what she was doing, but she would just let me hang out in the kitchen, and she would just be like, well, if you're going to be here, be here. But I'm not going to tell you anything about this.
I mean, were you like the kid with the getting up on the chair?
I've been fascinated by it since, you know, my earliest memories. You know?
Wow.
Yeah. And I remember, like if anyone has grown up in an apartment building with a laundromat in the basement, you know, I'd accompany, you know, my grandmother when she had to babysit me. I would go to the laundromat and I would pick up these old magazines, right? People would dump all their old magazines in a bin, and I'd pick up all the food magazines and I would collect them, you know. And I always said, like, you know, other kids were hiding Playboy magazines under their pillows.
Right, or maybe collecting baseball cards, and you're collecting old food magazines?
Yeah, I had old gourmet magazines and Bon Appetit magazines. This is crazy. And I would just read them, you know, and I would look at them, and when I would save my allowance money, and I would go shopping in Chinatown or something, and I'd buy these things, and I would make these recipes, you know, from scratch.
And would your father acknowledge that you were interested in cooking?
I really don't think they had any idea what I was doing. You know, they were very busy, and they were kind of had their own troubles to deal with. And I would like maybe once every few months I'd make these meals. And you know, the family would get together or the, you know, whatever, and I would cook these meals for them. And most 9 times out of 10, they came out horribly because, you know, I was like 10. So they were not. I would skip some major detail.
You were not a candidate for Top Chef Junior
or
Master Chef Junior?
I definitely was not. but, you know, they had to endure some pretty horrific meals when I was a kid. But I knew, I distinctly remember telling my parents, you know, I may have been 10 or 11, and I said, I'm going to be a chef.
Instead of a ball player, you were going to be a chef.
Yeah. And you know, it was funny because, whatever, as parents, right, you say, sure, you're going to be an astronaut, you're going to be a baseball player, and you figure your kid will grow out of that. And I remember, like, every few years they'd ask me, and I'd go, I'm going to be a chef. And I just kind of never outgrew it.
In the book, you talk about the episode of Mind of a Chef that you were on. Graffiti plays a big role in your teenage years.
You know, I grew up in New York City, in Brooklyn, you know, and I guess my formative years, right, when you start to kind of create your own identity, right, when you stop becoming your parents' kid and you become trying to become your own person. You know, I was lucky in some ways, I guess. Graffiti was really just this thing that had exploded and was everywhere, and people were talking about it. And it was the first art form, I truly believe, that was on a grassroots level. You know, I didn't have to go to a museum to see it. I didn't have to pay a fee to go to a gallery.
It
was street pop art, and it was something that was available. Not only was it available to everyone, but it was also my classmates at school were doing it. It was something that was very inside my culture. And it was for me, you know, as a young kid in Brooklyn, not knowing where I fit in, it was for me a tribe. You know, it was something, it was a group that I could belong to or that I could sort of, you know, attach myself to.
That's interesting. You called it a tribe. Mm-hmm. And I've been writing a book about the Serious Eats experience of creating this thing that nobody had ever created before, mm-hmm. and seeing it through, yeah. 10 years to its illogical conclusion. I've really been thinking a lot about tribes and how I created a tribe, mm-hmm. and how at Serious Eats and how important tribes are in general in our lives. Oh, and, you know, and it's not usually your family, right? The tribe is usually the people you choose. Mm-hmm. You know, you talk about tribes in the book about that chefs are tribes, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. Southern chefs especially. Mm-hmm. So that was your tribe. They were all graffiti artists. Yeah. So you
and it wasn't just like chefs aren't all just about cooking food. It wasn't just about writing graffiti, but it was that underculture, right? That sort of subculture that kind of existed in you know where I was in Brooklyn, and then subsequently in Lower Manhattan. It was something that was exciting to me. It was something very derelict
and a little dangerous.
It was very dangerous, and it was cool. And the girls thought it was sexy, and you know what better life? But you know, we were right at the point of Giuliani just starting to come into office, and you know, it was the end of that culture for good or bad. I'm not passing judgment on it, but you know, the crime in New York was going down. Everything graffiti was going to come to an end. Subway cars had changed, and you know, for me. I remember it was at that time, too, that I got my first job at a high-end restaurant and saw these rock star chefs and these badass waiters who would ride motorcycles and hang out and smoke cigarettes. And it was like these were even cooler than the.
So that was after college or that?
No, I actually got my first job. I was 15. I got my first job.
Where was that?
So this is a hilarious story, considering all the current political things going on right now. My first job in the restaurant industry, I was 15, and I applied for a busboy job at a restaurant called Terrace 5 that was on the fifth floor of Trump Tower. And I didn't get the job because I was too young. And so I went home, and the manager called me up that Friday and said, "Hey, the busboy we hired never showed up. If you can get here in 20 minutes, I will lie on your application. And you got the job."
Wow.
So I ran up there and, you know, got the job. And that was my first job, was being a busboy at this really, you know, small but very fine dining restaurant. And my second day on the job during the lunch shift, Michelle Pfeiffer came in with her bodyguard. and they said, "Hey, make a cappuccino for her." And I did. And I was so nervous that as I brought it to her table, I spilled and I burned my thumb. and I dropped this thing. It had more coffee in the saucer, I think, than in the cup.
That's awesome.
And she looked up at me and said, "Thank you." And that was, and it was like, and I literally remember that at the end of that shift going, "This is it. This is all I ever want to do."
That's funny. So let's get back to graffiti for a second, because you talk about how one of the things that made it interesting to you is that it was so temporal, mm-hmm. that it was transient. What about that appealed to you?
What I loved about it was that it wasn't precious, right? It was gritty. It was really, you know, you were talking about kids who knew that, many of whom knew that they were not going to be successful in this world, you know, in a sort of traditional sense. Many who might have, you know, some were on a death wish, you know, some didn't know if they were going to make it past their 17th birthday. And so this form of art, this kind of futile attempt at leaving some permanence on the world, mm-hmm. you know, knowing that this thing was going to get covered up in a week or two or a month, there was something both tragic and beautiful about it. And you know, I make the comparison, obviously, you know, hindsight's 20/20, but I make the comparison now that food is so much the same way. You know, food is so much about
a moment.
It's just a moment. It's just, you know, and it's the same thing, man. You go in and you have this chicken dish and it's sublime. The next week it may be just so-so, you know, and maybe there was a moment in that kitchen where this young guy was cooking it. He just, like put beauty on a plate.
Yeah. Eric Dolphy, said about music, who's a famous jazz
clarinetist. He's one of my favorites. Out to Lunch, one of my favorites.
Great record. He said, when you hear music, after it's over, it's gone. In the air, you can never capture it again.
Yeah. And there's something just absolutely beautiful about the memory of a dish. Just like I have memories of beautiful subway cars that I just know that, you know, back then we didn't have cell phone cameras. So, no, you know, there's very few pictures of these things. I have these memories of an entire subway, not just cars, but the entire subway line painted in one long mural. And it's absolutely, I mean, these are colossal works of art. They're almost impossible to imagine in your head that you could, you know, take 12 subway cars and make one piece going down from one end to the other.
Right.
It's incredible.
And then they would paint them over and they'd be gone.
And then you'd start again. And,
wow.
And it's kind of not unlike restaurants. I mean, you spend all day, an army of chefs creating this food. And in 3 hours, you know, hordes of customers come in and just consume and it's all gone. You just do it again the next day.
You mentioned in the book that you told your parents pretty early on, in your late teens, probably, that you really wanted to be a chef.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That didn't go down so well.
No, it did not. It did not.
Talk a little bit about that.
You know, it's a really interesting phenomenon that you know, I'm in my mid-40s. Anyone I talk to my age or older, I'm always curious. I'm always asking chefs, like, when did you decide to become a chef? How? And what did your parents say when you told them? And, you know, almost everyone's got a different path towards how they became a chef, but almost everyone has the same answer, especially if you were American, right? It's like their parents were all like, oh, boy. You know, just like they would just put their head in their hands and go, oh, really? And it's a very similar, I don't care what culture you come from. It just wasn't the thing to do. You know, it was very much in that time considered blue-collar. I mean, it still is, you know, but it was really a blue-collar job. It was kind of a dead-end job.
And you were thought by your parents to be hurtling backwards in time.
Very much so. And you were, you know, for my parents, they said to me, they said, you're being a servant. You're choosing a life of servitude, you know. And, you know, of course, my rebuttal was, hey, you become an accountant, you're still serving someone. They didn't want to hear that. I was kind of a smart aleck. They didn't like those answers. You know, there was no celebrity chef back then. There was no ownership of your destiny, ownership of your career. You were basically just, you know.
An employee.
Yeah, you're just an employee, making money and probably doing drugs, you know, which many of my peers were, you know.
Right.
And I was too at some point. And it was not considered something, you know, your parents didn't go bragging to their friends about your job. So it was something, and especially for an immigrant family, you know, who's very proud of their firstborn son, it's a thing. It was something that was very upsetting to them. I mean, to the point where my dad did not talk to me for a long time.
Wow. I mean, yeah, it's funny. I see parallels between you and Roy Choi, mm-hmm, another mm-hmm. Korean American, and David Chang, mm-hmm. in that you said your father stopped talking to you for a long time. So that it must have been a very freighted relationship for many years, right?
My dad died a few years ago. I write about it in the book. He's never eaten a meal that I've cooked in his entire life.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, and that was it. And it wasn't so much that, you know, it wasn't that he disowned me or that it was just something that he just did not want to be a part of. He didn't want to be a part. Even and he did, you know, luckily see a part of my success. But even to that end, it just wasn't something that he was very proud of.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't his dream.
Yeah, you talked about that he never really acknowledged, like, you didn't have much of a relationship with him, right?
Yeah. Again, some of it's a tragic. Part of it is, too, you choose your tribe.
Yeah.
And you know, for many times, especially with people who choose artistic or creative outlets, you know, your tribe usually does not include your family.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you create your own family elsewhere.
And you speak in Buttermilk Graffiti about flying home from Seattle to be with your father in his last hours, right?
Yeah.
And you were sad for a lot of reasons, not just because he was dying, but also because you never bridged the gap.
Yeah. And I just knew that, you know, there was this moment where I kind of just, you know, kissed him on the forehead and said, it's okay. Like,
we're good.
I'm not mad at you. But there is, you know, I mean, to this day, it's you know, I wish he had eaten something I cooked. I wish he had approved of something I, you know. And it's a very, you know, I always say little boys just want the approval of their dads, you know. And it doesn't matter if you're a 50-year-old man or a 12-year-old boy. It's something that you crave. And it's something that I knew, and I knew early on that it would never happen. But it's something, you know, it was interesting writing that chapter. It was it's probably the most personal chapter in the book. And it's something that, it just made sense when I was talking about Seattle, because my dad died he got sick while I was on book tour in Seattle. And, you know, I wrote that chapter. It was the fastest chapter that I wrote. I mean, it just kind of came out. And when we were reviewing the manuscript before submitting, I looked at it. Because, you know, writing's very personal for me.
Yes.
I was just writing. It was just me and my editor. And so, you know, 6 months later, when the manuscript's all done, I looked at it and I said, you know, we should just cut this chapter out. And I didn't want that chapter to go.
Because it was too revealing?
Yeah, and it wasn't something that the rest of the book is kind of framed around. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of a one-off. And you know, there are some other personal stories, but that was really personal. But anyway, I'm glad she convinced me to leave it in there. But one of the first things I did was I did this workshop at Stanford University. It was a creative writing workshop for people who are writing about their memoirs memoirs.
Right.
And the professor said, do you mind reading this passage from that chapter? Now, I had never read it out loud, right? You know, I wrote it and I submitted it and then we proofread it, but I'd never actually heard those words spoken out loud because I never...
And were you very moved?
I almost broke down in tears.
I'm sure.
In front of
it's a very moving passage.
In front of these students who are just here to do a workshop. And I'm just, I start choking up. I'm like, oh man, I'm not going to cry in front of these students. And it took everything I had. And I made a promise to myself that I would never read that chapter out loud again.
All right, so I'm not going to ask you to read that chapter. And yet, you know, you have this freighted, problematic relationship with your dad, but yet your relationship with your mom, as we got to see in your episode of Mind of a Chef, you were very, very close.
Yeah, yeah.
Dare I say you relaxed. It seems like you had a very comfortable relationship with her.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that a lot of that it's developed after I became a chef. What's interesting is, as a son who has a relationship with his mother, you know, at a certain point in adulthood, you kind of lose or you run out of things to talk about, right? I mean, just you live very different lives and you're in this, myself included, there's not really much that, you know, I'm not a part of her Mahjong club and I don't know a lot about what she does with her friends. But the one thing we have in common is food. And she subsequently, once she kind of retired, she started cooking a lot. And I think there was a little bit of guilt that she never really cooked for me a lot when she was younger because she was busy working. And so she cooks a lot. And so we kind of sometimes just get on the phone and talk about food and recipes. And
wow,
like,
what is that?
You know, but we're not really talking about food. We're talking to each other.
You're connecting.
Yeah. But we connect, but, you know, it's like I can't just call her. She can't just call me up and say hi. She has to be like, I need something. What is that thing that you did with the recipe you put in? I'm like, that was something like that. And then, you know, we end up talking. And it's interesting that through food I've been able to have a sort of a second chance at a relationship with my mom.
Wow, that's so interesting. Now, you were cooking to make money even when you were in, like, you talk about cooking in diners, you know, and one of your restaurants in Louisville is kind of your version of a diner,
yes,
right?
Yes, definitely.
And that's, it's called Whiskey Down.
Whiskey Dry.
Whiskey Dry, yeah. Which is a diner expression for dry rye toast,
yes,
I believe.
Yes, exactly.
See, that's not bad, right?
That's not bad at all.
So what did you learn from cooking in diners?
Oh, my God, I learned everything. I learned everything. I learned how to deal with criminals coming into your restaurant. I learned how to be a cook and a bouncer at the same time. You know, back then I was going through college and working my way through college, working at a diner on 28th and Madison. There's something about having, I always say, like, you don't have to be smart to be a good chef, but you have to have a certain smarts. Like, there's a certain part of your brain that you need. You have to be able to juggle a lot. And I was just remember working in this diner and you know, with these, you know, Latino cooks who'd been there forever. And you know, there was no POS system. There was no organized. I mean, it was just there were verbal orders, and they would come in, and I would work breakfast, you know, and it's like, you know, eggs 32 over easy, two eggs scrambled all the way, whiskey down, you know, and just calling out, you know, order after order after order. And, you know, I just remembered very early on that I could just remember the orders. Like, it just wasn't a thing. And it was funny that one of the first memories I have is in the diners, the Latino cooks who kind of, you know, were laughing at me at first. And you know, after a week went by, they actually kind of were like, all right. You know, they gave me a pat on the back and they said, you got this. It wasn't so much that I knew that I was going to be a great chef, right? But I just knew that being in a kitchen to me was not intimidating. It was not. In fact, I could easily sort of rattle off the things. I could juggle a lot of things in my brain. Didn't mean I was smart because I, you know, my grades in school weren't that good. But that part of it, it gave me the confidence to go, okay, this is not that hard. Granted, I was cooking eggs and toast and burgers, but, you know, it's a progression. You start there and you kind of go on, and it definitely piqued my curiosity to go to say, like, what else is out there?
Right.
What else?
And did you feel at home, like, when you were there, even in a diner kitchen?
I loved every minute of it, even with the rats at 5 a.m. when I was trying to get the pancake batter ready, you know. It was
like, and the rats only, they don't even have cash, right? They don't even have anything to pay you.
And you're in their house. Right, you know, they're not intruders in your establishment. You're in their house.
So, how and when did you make the leap to having your own restaurant? You went to NYU, right?
Went to NYU, yeah.
But you had already told your parents you wanted to be a chef. But did you tell them it's okay? I'm going to graduate from college.
Yeah, I mean, that was the one promise I made to them. Right, was I was going to have a degree from, you know, an American university. So I it's funny, I ended up graduating from NYU, but I never went to graduation because I got a job right after that, traveling. And so they still were, I even still think today, they're kind of suspicious that my diploma is not real and it's kind of forged. Because for them, like, not going to a ceremony, like, that was the whole thing, was a ceremony.
So you didn't do the cap and gown?
I never did. And I told them, I argued with them, I said, listen, I did. I got the diploma. I graduated. The ceremony was not part of the deal.
Right.
You know, I graduated. So they're still suspicious.
I think we should call NYU and they'll send you a violet cap and gown so you can ship them to your mom.
We should do that. And with class of whatever it was. Yeah.
So you started cooking in restaurants. And then you talk about in one of the books about You actually had your own restaurant very briefly in Chinatown. Mm-hmm. Now, what was that called? Because you wouldn't say.
It was called Clay.
Okay.
We opened in 98. And it was really interesting. I didn't plan to, you know, I was 25. You know, I didn't plan to open a restaurant. This was not my thing. But it was just this weird thing. I was walking down Chinatown and there was this, you know, literally the guy was putting up a for rent sign. And I started talking to him, you know, and I was cooking. I was cooking at like two different kitchens. I was doing everything. At that point, I was driven. I knew
in
I was
serious
gonna be
restaurants.
A chef. Yeah, and I said, and we just started talking. And I said, the rent is how much? And he was like, you know, I'll give you this, and there's an apartment space next door, and you can have it for like, you know, $2,200 a month. You know,
we're talking
about 1,200 square feet, a little over 1,200 square feet for 20. And I was like, this is ridiculous. And it didn't, and it was a Chinese restaurant. So the kitchen was, it didn't need much work. And I knew I wasn't ready. And I knew, like, I had no experience. I had no business doing it. But in my twisted head, I thought, well, what if we did this and I made some money and then I could take that money and enroll in actual cooking school?
And it didn't end so well, right?
No, it you know, we were doing really, actually we were doing really well, and we got tons of accolades and New York Times and stuff that I just had no idea about the whole food media world. You know, and then 9/11 happened, and that was in 2001, and we were very close to 9/11, and I was, you know, at the time I was, you know, I was admittedly partying too much. And, you know, it's just, I was losing focus, and this wasn't the food that I wanted to cook. It was just something that, I did a nice little fun Korean barbecue joint, you know, and we were doing well. And after 9/11, my landlord came up to me and said, "Hey, by the way, your lease is up in 2 years, and your rent is going up from, you know, at the time it was almost like $3,000 a month. He said it's going up from $3,000 to $13,000, you know, for a small space." Yeah, and so I saw the writing on the wall. You know, I had a friend of mine who died in the towers, and you know, my girlfriend at the time left. And moved to Italy, and so there's just a lot of things happening. Also, I was just kind of burnt out. You know, I had done this thing to have fun, and it ceased to be fun. You know,
yeah.
and I was probably doing more extracurricular activities than actually cooking. And so I kind of reassessed my life and said, you know, this is not. This is and I just saw the writing on the wall, like real estate's, you know, this little neighborhood when I opened up was not called Nolita.
Right.
And I saw all these, you know, like incredibly expensive boutiques popping up. And I thought, you know, this is not where I want to be.
Yeah.
And so I just took a hiatus and went to Kentucky.
Yeah. And how did you end up in Louisville?
Just complete serendipity. I went there. Someone suggested I go there. There was they knew a friend of a friend who needed a chef or needed some hands during Derby Week, which is always a very busy time of year. And I'd always wanted to go to the Kentucky Derby. I'd always been kind of a country music fan. And so I went down there on a whim, and I absolutely fell in love with it. I always say, you know, it's a funny story. I went down for Derby, right? So there was all these gorgeous women in beautiful hats and dresses, and you know, the flowers are blooming, and there's celebrities and cool people out, and I thought, this is the coolest place in the world. No one told me it's not like that the other 51 weeks out of the year.
So did you get past that? Did you learn to love Louisville? Louisville.
Yes, Louisville. I mean, it's home. It's home. No, so the person I worked for at the time, I worked for him for a week. His name was Eddie Garber, and he had this beautiful restaurant, but he was old and wanted to retire. And I literally spent 1 week with him. And
wow.
At the end of the week, he said, "You should move down here and take over the restaurant." And I said, "You're crazy. I just came down here for just to clear my head for a week and just wanted to hang out." And he said, "No, you're going to do it." And I went back to New York, and he was very persistent, and he called me like once every week just to catch up, and you know, it took about 6 months, and I was like, "You're right. I have nothing here in New York. My lease is up. My life's in shambles. You know, I'm depressed, and I don't like cooking. You know, I don't like cooking the food I'm cooking. I just need something. I didn't know what I needed or what I wanted. I just needed to get out of there, and I did. And I said, "Listen, I'll stay for 6 months. If I don't like it, I can always move back." And 6 months turned into 16 years.
Over. Wow. Yeah. What an incredible story. There's some serendipity there, isn't there?
It's a lot of serendipity. And also, you know, what I didn't realize at the time, and you know, I always tell people, like, it wasn't my intention, it wasn't, but I moved to Louisville, Kentucky, and fell in love with Southern food. You know, I fell in love with the lore, the flavors, the stories, the people.
Biscuits, fried chicken.
The whole gambit. Which I, you know, I, unlike, you know, a true Southerner, I grew up in Brooklyn. I never grew up with that. You know, I didn't have fried chicken.
No.
You know, I didn't have all
and
this
New
stuff.
York is even now not a great fried chicken
no.
town.
And I remember, you know, one of the, maybe I was in Louisville at the time, like 6 months or so, and I went to a soul food restaurant and ate a bowl of collard greens. And I always remember eating that, my first bowl of collard greens in Louisville, Kentucky, and feeling like I found home, you know, in a bowl of collard greens.
Wow.
And that's what kept me in Louisville. That's what kept me there is it wasn't necessarily that Louisville itself was mine. It was that the food and this and the whole idea of this food that transformed me. And I feel like I found my voice there where I could sort of, you know, now I could combine these two worlds. And go, "Well, I'm never going to cook traditional Southern food, right?
Yeah.
Because I'm not from the South. But I'm never going to cook traditional Korean food. And I've had all these experiences, and very little of it's actually Korean. But you know, there is this amalgam of all these experiences and things that come together, and I sort of play around with them."
Right, which is the perfect segue to talking about Buttermilk Graffiti, which we haven't talked that much about. And so we're going to wrap up this episode of Special Sauce. And then we're going to keep talking for another episode.
Okay.
So long, Serious Eaters. So we'll see you next time. thank you for coming too. I should say, you know, I'm rude, Ed, but thank you for coming.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.